This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Please take care while listening and email us at svri@svri.org for resources.
Welcome to another episode of the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I'm Aisha Margo.
And I am Elizabeth Dartnell. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we're discussing how we measure the effectiveness of violence prevention interventions. Can the way we assess outcomes be improved?
We use outcome measures to decide whether a program has been impactful in addressing violence against women and violence against children. And this is an incredibly important part of the process, as measuring the effectiveness of our interventions helps us to refine them, to know which are replicable and scalable, and to spend more time doing what actually works.
But there are many limitations in the way we measure outcomes currently, with our field often focusing on using binary, single outcome measures. Sangeeta Chatterjee is a lecturer at the University of Edinburgh and co-author of a new paper that challenges our current methods, suggesting the need to capture more nuance when assessing impacts.
Sangeeta starts by explaining what we mean when we say binary outcome measures.
The most common outcome measures that are used in most of the evaluation studies is using a binary outcome measure of any versus no physical and or sexual violence. That's the most commonly used outcome measure, although I must say that more recently, a lot of evaluation studies are including secondary outcome measures that do look at different types of violence. So including outcome measures like any versus no physical violence, any versus no sexual violence, emotional violence. So definitely looking at different kinds and types of violence. So those are the outcome measures that are typically used so far. The measures that we use are also say something about where we are as a field, because I think in the earlier days when violence wasn't, I guess, as much recognized as a public health issue, there wasn't as much information on it. There was a lot more focus on getting more prevalence data. And so then we had those prevalence surveys in the late 90s, early 2000s. And that's why then those outcome measures were more focused on like getting a summary statistics, which would help us know about like the prevalence of violence. And that's sort of like the legacy that we are left with. But now, as we've moved past that, there have been so many intervention studies conducted in so many different parts of the world. As we now have like this growing knowledge base of all of these intervention studies, as well as prevalence studies, now we can actually, I think, move forward to think about, okay, the default measures that we use, are they serving us well? And if not, then what can we do? Because we do collect a lot of detailed, rich data from our respondents. And in some ways, we're also doing a disservice to them if we're not like, you know, doing as much nuanced analysis as we can, because our goal is to actually, you know, be able to impact people's lives in the nuanced ways lives can be, because, you know, it's all messy and complicated.
As a relatively new field, there are many reasons we've gravitated towards using binary outcome measures, the any versus no metric, including the initial focus on prevalence studies like Sangeeta mentioned. But it is important to point out that while Sangeeta's work is identifying how to add more nuance to our measurements, she did tell us that the current methods aren't all bad. What Sangeeta suggests is these methods aren't painting a complete picture.
Sangeeta and her team reanalyzed secondary data from 6 randomized control trials conducted in low and middle-income countries to assess how different conceptualizations and coding of intimate partner violence variables can influence interpretations of the impact of an intervention. She tells us about this research and why she decided to challenge the prevailing convention.
I think it was actually other researchers that made us think of doing things a little differently. So when we were working on analyzing the impact of the Indashikirwa trial in Rwanda. And Indashikirwa has four components, but we were looking at the impact of the couples-based intervention as well as the community-based intervention. And when we looked at the literature, we saw that SASA, in the evaluation of SASA, which was a community mobilization intervention that took place in Uganda, they looked at the difference in the impact of the intervention on primary versus secondary prevention. And primary prevention is preventing the onset of violence before it begins, and secondary prevention is focused on reducing or stopping ongoing violence. And they found that their intervention was slightly more effective in reducing ongoing sexual and physical IPV rather than preventing the onset of those types of IPVs. So a little bit more effective in secondary rather than primary prevention. And that really got our interest going, because we thought, okay, let's look at the couples intervention data from Indashikirwa and see if we do see kind of similar differences. Because we did have, a lot of the couples did report ongoing violence at baseline. So that was another thing that we were interested in seeing, if we did see a difference in the type of prevention the intervention was successful in. And in terms of severity, there was some research done with the Songke Change trial, where I think they found a difference in the type of impact based on severity. I think they had seen a greater reduction in IPV among less violent and more law-abiding men than among more highly violent men. So there was some research that had been done, but in different pockets. And that's what got us on this direction to do this study. And so initially, we took data from Indashikirwa, from the couples-based intervention, and looked at differences in secondary and primary prevention. And we did find differences. And then we also looked at data from the Stepping Stones Creating Futures trial, where again, we found differences in secondary and primary prevention. And that's what sort of got us going in this direction. And then that made us write up the grant proposal and ask for funding. And once we were able to do that, we decided that in the first step, we had only looked at differences in primary and secondary prevention. But now we wanted to look at, and Indashikirwa and Stepping Stones Creating Futures are very, very different interventions. So it's kind of hard to like make comparisons between them for good reasons. But in the next step, we decided we wanted to also look at differences in impact by severity. And that's one of the main things that we were able to do in this study, where what we did is that we took data from 7 trials, and then we reanalyzed the trial data using different outcome measures that looked at different degrees of severity, as well as again looking at differences in the impact of intervention based on primary and secondary prevention. And originally, we did want to include different studies with very different contexts from South America, Africa, and Asia, but then we realized that the scope was too wide. So we are limited to countries within Africa, but we did manage to get 7 trials, and then we were able to do the analysis, largely in part in thanks to all of the teams who were willing to do this work with us. So like a massive thank you to each of the different teams who worked with us and did the analysis for us that then allowed me and the rest of the team to synthesize the findings. So very much a group effort, and you cannot do research of this scale alone. It always requires a big team and willingness to be able to do these kinds of things.
So what did Sangeeta and her team learn in their analysis? Did a more nuanced approach offer a better understanding of the impacts of the interventions?
So what we did find is that there were definitely differences in the impact of interventions, both based on the severity of IPV as well as the type of prevention, so whether it was primary or secondary prevention. And I hesitate to talk about differences. You know, we didn't actually observe any trends across studies. And each of the interventions, they were very different from each other, and the contexts were also very different. So I also don't think it actually makes sense to compare across trials, but it's more meaningful to look at differences in impact within each intervention. I think that's still quite helpful. And I can talk about a couple that were most interesting, but a little bit in the beginning, I just want to discuss some of the outcomes that we did test out. So we looked at different degrees of severity of physical violence. So we have the WHO items that we typically ask, and these are usually 5 or 6 items. And so we divided them into categories of moderate versus severe physical violence based on the type of act of violence. So if you're familiar with the WHO questions, for example, you typically ask, in the past 12 months, how often has your partner slapped you or thrown something at you that could hurt you? And typically the response options are never, once, a few times, many times. And so you typically have information on the type of act as well as the frequency. And here, to measure the severity of physical violence, we're not using the information on severity. We're only using the information on type of act of physical violence. And so based on the CTS, the conflict tactics scale, they had classified moderate physical violence as comprising of the 2 acts of pushing or slapping or throwing something as moderate physical violence, and then all the other acts of physical violence, which is hitting, kicking, choking, or threatening with a weapon, as more severe physical violence. So using that definition, we developed 2 outcome measures. One is moderate only physical violence. So this only measures whether an individual experienced or perpetrated any moderate physical violence. It excludes any acts of severe physical violence. And then the other one was severe physical violence, which can include moderate violence, but largely is only looking, you would have had to experience at least 1 act of severe violence to be coded as having experienced severe physical violence. And so we do find differences in the impact of interventions based on the degree of severity of physical violence. And one of the ones that really stand out that show this difference is the results for Indashi Kirwa. So originally, based on the traditional outcome measure of any physical violence versus none, the intervention was shown to have no impact on men's perpetration of physical violence. But then when we use these new outcome measures, we saw that actually the intervention was able to impact moderate only physical violence. It just didn't have any impact on severe physical violence. So that was an important finding that would have been lost if we had not looked at these nuanced differences. And it also helps us unpack some interesting or more nuanced data. For example, like with Becoming One, which is an intervention with faith leaders, we see that the intervention did have an impact on physical violence, on the traditionally coded outcome measure of any physical violence. But then when we look at differences by severity, we see that the intervention was able to impact severe physical violence, but it had no impact on moderate only physical violence. So it allows us to dig a little deeper into understanding what's actually going on in terms of impact, and which you can then use to refine your intervention. And then the other measure of severity was a measure of emotional violence. And here, as I said earlier on, we typically include information on both types of acts of violence as well as frequency. And for emotional violence, we developed 2 new measures. And for these measures, we did actually include information from both the type of act as well as the frequency of experiencing this act of emotional violence. So for example, high-intensity emotional violence includes any individuals who would have reported experiencing or perpetrating both insults and humiliation, which is two types of acts of emotional violence, often or many times, or experiencing or perpetrating threats, for example, often or many times. And so what we did is that we, using information from both the frequency and type of act, we developed two new binary outcome measures, which is moderate and or high intensity emotional violence versus low or none, and high intensity emotional violence versus low or no emotional IPV. And then again, using these new outcome measures, we do see differences in results based on using a traditional outcome measure of any versus no emotional IPV versus these new outcome measures. And some of the examples that really highlight this is findings, for example, from Unite for a Better Life in Ethiopia. We see that using the traditional outcome measure of any versus no emotional IPV, we saw no impact for women. But then when we do use these two new measures, we do see an impact on moderate and or high intensity emotional violence, as well as on high intensity emotional violence only. So again, something that could have been missed. And again, it allows us to drill down into some nuanced impacts. So similarly, again, for becoming one, the intervention with faith leaders, we do see an impact on the traditionally coded outcome measure of any versus no emotional IPV. And then when we use the new outcome measures, we do see an impact on moderate and or high intensity emotional violence, but no impact on high intensity only emotional violence. So a little bit more nuance. And the last two is we use two different measures of severe physical and or sexual violence. One is using the What Works measure, which usually where an individual is coded as having experienced severe physical and or sexual violence if they experienced more than one act of physical and or sexual violence or experienced one act more than once. So both a measure of the number of acts or the frequency. So it's a tricky one, but easier when you read it. And the other one is just limited to severe physical violence based on like the type of act of severe physical violence, which I had described earlier, or any act of sexual violence. And so again, we see differences in the impact of interventions on these two measures of severe physical and or sexual violence compared to like the original, any traditional coding of any physical and or sexual violence. And Unite for a Better Life for Women, we do see an impact when we use the traditionally outcome or coded outcome measure of any physical and or sexual violence. But then between these two new outcome measures, we only see an impact when using the severe physical and or sexual violence outcome, but we don't see an impact when using the What Works measure for severe physical and or sexual violence. So it's important to think about how we're coding and understanding severity. And the reason this is because the What Works measure of severe physical and or sexual violence includes moderate acts of physical violence, whereas the other measure of severe physical and or sexual violence is limited to the severe acts of physical violence as defined by the CTS. So, you know, you can have differences in results based on the measures that you use. So it's important to think about also how they were coded and what they included.
The work of Sangeeta and her team has quite profound implications for our field. It is possible we may say something doesn't work, only to find it is actually effective for certain populations when we take this more nuanced approach. Could measuring outcomes in a binary way lead to potentially effective interventions being abandoned prematurely?
Definitely. I mean, that is one of the things that we found, that of course, if you use, for example, with some of the traditionally coded outcome measures, you don't see an impact, but you do see an impact using some of the newer, more nuanced measures. But then you can also see differences between the newer, more nuanced measures. So I think one of the takeaways is that, of course, we have to be careful when we're looking at the results for any intervention study, looking at the methods section and understanding how they've measured and outcome measures. Important to pay attention to that for sure. But I think in terms of like the two measures for severe physical and or sexual violence, one of the reasons we tested out both was that in the WhatWorks consortium, the measure for the WhatWorks measure for severe physical and or sexual violence, we did think that it had some limitations. And that is something that we wanted to showcase. Now, it has limitations based on the definition of severity that is most relevant to you. And so, because, you know, one of the measures of severity that we've gone with is using the original CTS and their classification of severe versus moderate physical violence. And that's sort of the framework that we have used. Whereas in the WhatWorks measure, that is not the framework that was used. The way that we assess severity with the WhatWorks measure is based more on the frequency. So experiencing more than one act or experiencing more than once. So again, different ways of thinking about severity, which is one of the implications and recommendations from our research and something that we found when we were trying to develop these outcome measures, that actually there's no consensus in the field on how we measure severity. People are doing it very differently. Some studies are using a single measure. Some studies are using latent class analysis to come up with like different thresholds of severity, where then it's based on like the data for that study. So different people have, you know, used different metrics or measures or thresholds of severity. And I do think that it's really important for us as a field to really dig into this and think of, you know, do more work to understand what are the thresholds of severity that are more relevant to us, and also do some work with victims and survivors. I think it's also important to co-produce some research with them to understand, you know, what are the thresholds of severity that are most relevant for them. Because some of the, like the original work in the CTS on what is moderate versus severe violence is based on injury data or health consequences data. Now, that is one perspective with which you're understanding severity, and it may or may not be the perspective that is most relevant to victims or survivors.
So, if we were to implement the findings of this research, what barriers might we face? Sangeeta explains.
One of the biggest barriers might be funding, just because I think one of the recommendations that we have is that, you know, when we're thinking about the outcome measures that we do want to use in our intervention studies, it's important that they be both theoretically driven as well as contextually driven. And one way to do that is to ensure that you do have a good baseline study that you do a baseline prevalence study as well. So you are able to like get an understanding of the context where the intervention is being developed, as well as what the baseline prevalence is. And this helps you sort of decide whether you want to have a binary measure or a continuous measure might be better suited. And also thinking in terms of like the intervention, do you want it to have an impact on primary and secondary prevention, maybe just one or the other? So to make more informed decisions when you are designing both the intervention as well as the evaluation study. And so to be able to do this, you definitely need more funding for a longer design phase. So that is something that we hope that funders would be receptive to. The other thing is also, I think one more barrier might be that we have sort of recommended many different outcome measures. And I think one of our recommendations is that you should choose what makes the most sense based on your context. So we're also hoping that people are able to make more informed decisions based on the context. Because I don't think the solution is, at least we shy away from saying, this is the best way to do it. That's not true. It's based on like what works the best for your, what makes the most sense for like your study and the goals of your intervention, actually. So definitely there as well. And I think there's also a tendency to want to go back to the default and use more traditional outcome measures, because it does allow for easier comparison across trials and evaluation studies, because, you know, you can say that study achieved an impact of this percentage or magnitude. And you can only say that when you are comparing using the same outcome measure. So that might be a limitation as well.
It's been so interesting to learn about how our understanding of impact can change so drastically when we simply alter the way we interpret the data. Let's drill down now into the main takeaways and learnings from this work.
The most important takeaway is the process that we hope trialists or people working on evaluation studies can undertake, which is one is, of course, reporting on a wide range of meaningful outcomes that are theoretically and contextually driven. Also having a longer design phase that allows for like a baseline study where you can actually collect information on baseline prevalence that helps you then decide, is a binary outcome measure the best or should I also include a continuous measure? As well as thinking about like, do we want to include measures for primary and secondary prevention? Then also being able to have larger sample sizes, because to do any of these kind of more nuanced analysis, you need to ensure that you have an adequate sample size, right? For example, for the analysis that we did on primary and secondary prevention, you need to ideally have an equal group of people at baseline who report no ongoing violence, as well as a group that is reporting ongoing violence, to actually be able to meaningfully compare them to see if the intervention has a similar impact on primary versus secondary prevention. So being able to make those decisions early on so that you do have an adequate sample size for these kinds of more involved analysis. And I also think it's really important for interventions to have a clear theory of change, where you also specify what are the pathways of change based on the socioeconomic context, because that's another area I think where we are lagging behind. We often know whether interventions work or not, but we don't know how they worked, you know, because the logical next step from our analysis, right? We can see that we have differences in impact based on severity or the kind of type of prevention. And then what at least I want to know then is, oh, was the pathway of change different based on the severity, degree of severity of violence or the type of prevention or the subgroup? And to drill into that a little bit more, but we don't actually have a gold standard for this kind of like pathway analysis. We don't often do it. And I don't blame the field. It's about where we are at, like at a developmental stage. We're still trying to identify what interventions work or not. But I think now we can definitely do more pathway analysis. We also similarly don't have like a gold standard for the best modeling strategy. Like, what is the best modeling strategy for like binary or continuous outcome measures? And this often comes up. And so we definitely need more work there as well. And also being mindful of methodological issues, I think, because one of the cons of recommending reporting on a wide range of outcomes is then making interpretations based on these different outcomes and being very mindful, because, you know, when you look at these different results for these different outcomes, looking at the confidence intervals, because if they're overlapping, then you know that, you know, there's something going on there. So the difference might not be as big as you think it is. So being mindful and drilling down a little, I guess, more deeper when you're making those inferences. So being careful, it's sort of like a double-edged sword, but being mindful when you are making those inferences, especially when comparing across. And we definitely, I think, need more measurement research to sort of replicate these kind of measures with different interventions in different contexts. A lot of our analysis is very specific to that specific context. So definitely needs more replication. And then moving it forward, right? Looking at pathways, for example. So those, I think, are the most important things for us.
So should we now be creating a new way of assessing outcomes that could be used as a template for all future intervention assessments globally?
I think it would be, we could develop like a guidance of like these are the range of different outcome measures that you could use, and like practical information on how you would code it and go about analyzing it. You know, it could be like sort of a guide. These are the options you have, and then leaving it to people to choose the ones that are most relevant for them and their side, and also sort of making recommendations on the sort of deliberate process that you should undertake when choosing outcomes. So definitely, I think there should be guidance, but no messaging on this is the way to do it. That I think is not useful for anyone.
And finally, how optimistic is Sangeeta that this work will be picked up and that we will adopt more nuanced outcome measures in the future?
I am very optimistic because I think based even on our work that we had done in the paper that came out in 2020, looking at differences in impact on primary and secondary prevention, we know that there are other trialists who have actually picked it up and have replicated some of that analysis. And then, for example, with the EMAP intervention, they have looked at differences based on severity. So I think there is an interest and appetite. It might just take a little bit of time. And in any case, with the life cycle of these intervention studies, right, it takes 7 to 8 years for something to come up. So I'm also very mindful that it might take time. But I do think that we are moving forward. And I think if we are able to get the message to a wider group of people, as well as some support, like, I mean, I'm happy to talk to people who might be thinking of doing this kind of evaluation research to help with coding or analysis. I think if we are also able to create sort of resources that people can access, whether that's even just a supportive community where you can ask questions that actually come up in each and every evaluation study, and we just, you know, sort of solve it in our own networks. But if we widen that and make it more accessible, I think it'll definitely go ahead, as well as some funding for this to encourage.
A big thanks to Sangeeta Chatterjee for joining us on the podcast. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margo. You've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit www.svri.org.
To free the world of violence against women and violence against children, we must connect, we have to learn, and we must share. So please subscribe, like, and review us on Apple Podcasts, and share this episode far and wide.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.